All right, Willow, this is week three of Celebration of Hope. This is the week that we get to participate. We're going to take an offering at the end of the service that goes toward fueling the work of our global partners around the world, and that is an exciting thing that we get to do today. We already got to celebrate here in South Barrington to all of our locations that we packed the last seed pack or the millionth seed pack last night. So at all of our locations and online, can we just go ahead and be excited about that? Super excited about that. And I got to go around to a lot of the campuses and see all the work that volunteers did to in our lobbies to sort of inform us of all the amazing things that are going on around the world. So can we give it up for all of our volunteers at all of our locations? Super exciting. Well, we met Nehemiah 2 weeks ago at the first week of Celebration of Hope, and we learned that he was a cupbearer to the king, which at first we thought, that might not be a great job, because basically your job is to taste the king's wine and food to make sure that no one is poisoning him. So if someone's poisoning the king, you're the one that's going to take the brunt of that. So it sounds like not a great job. But the truth is, once everybody knows that the king has a cupbearer and realizes that the poisoning wouldn't work, it's probably a pretty good job. Because people don't poison the king if they can't get through the cupbearer. So really, as long as the king can trust that the cupbearer will not deceive him, then the king is pretty safe, and the cupbearing job is a fairly easy job. You get to live in the palace. You get to go where the king goes. You get to eat the king's food. You get to drink the king's wine. You get to be in the comfort of the palace. But Nehemiah, in that first week, he got word that his homeland was in shambles, and it started to weigh on him, and he started to pray about this, and he decides, I can't hold on to the comfort of the palace anymore, and Nehemiah is going to choose courage over comfort. And that's where we join him this week. I'm in Nehemiah 2:11, and it says this. Basically, after Nehemiah gets permission from the king to go back to Jerusalem and begin to think about how are we going to get this work done in Jerusalem, it says these few little words, five words. It says, so I arrived in Jerusalem. But can I stop there? Because in those five little words, you're missing a lot. This is a 750-mile journey that Nehemiah goes on. That's like going from here basically to New York City. And that's going to take about 12 hours for us in a car going 70 miles an hour, but they didn't have cars, obviously. So this is going to take months for them. They're on a journey that maybe doesn't have well-worn roads, probably not well-worn trails. They're on maybe camels from time to time, maybe horseback. But this is a long journey, and over the course of this journey, they have the danger of mercenaries, of bandits on the side of the road. And then once they get to Jerusalem, basically Nehemiah is going to lead the people in manual labor. We're going to find out that he's got all kinds of critics that are saying, no, you can't do this, and you shouldn't do this, and you're a traitor to the king. So he's got a lot of horrible, tough things ahead, but he chooses a courageous calling to rebuild his homeland over the comfort of the palace. And I think for me personally, over this past year, as I've met a lot of our global partners, that's one of the things that stood out to me, is that a lot of these people got to go to college, they were well connected, they could have, if they wanted to, chosen very comfortable careers, and yet what they chose to do, they chose a courageous calling to go to their homeland, or to go to a tough place and do tough work to rebuild a community. And they choose that over comfort. Sometimes it's hard work. Sometimes it's dangerous work that our partners have done. This past year, our partners in Rajasthan, India, they were organizing a conference with about 250 Christ followers coming together. And they were interrupted in the middle of it by Hindu extremists who came in and accused them of illegal activity. And it even, this conflict erupted into violence. Got on the news. It was a pretty big deal. And throughout that incident, our Indian Christian brothers and sisters, they chose not to retaliate. Instead, what they chose to do was they decided they were going to open up the wells that we own over there and the wells that they own over there and open up the schools that they have over there and allow the attackers to participate in those things. Now, what happened was the onlookers, they watched this happen, and what resulted in that Christian kindness was that 15 people came to Christ, and they ended up planting a church there because our partners chose Christian love over retaliation. But then, the 15 people that became Christ followers and started a church in that town, they started to get abused physically, attacked physically, violence. They stuck with it. They decided they were going to show the same Christian love, and now there are two more churches planted in that region as people saw that Christian kindness and decided this can be explained in no other way. We've got to follow this Jesus that everybody's talking about, and right now we ought to applaud because that is an awesome, awesome thing. And it begs the question for me and hopefully you as well. Following God comfortably, what does that look like for you? What does following God comfortably look like? There have been times when I've followed him comfortably. And then what does following God courageously look like to you? Very specifically, as we prepare to take an offering today to fund and to fuel the work of our global partners around the world, let me ask you this. What does a comfortable COH gift look like for you? And what does a courageous COH gift look like for you? I want to be a community that's courageous. Well, here's what we know. Courageous is contagious. Courageous is contagious because basically the king lets Nehemiah go to Jerusalem. Once Nehemiah gets to Jerusalem, he starts to tell other people about this vision to rebuild the wall. And look what it says in Nehemiah 2, verse 17. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we're in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace." And the people responded to his courage with courage and enthusiasm. And they replied, "Well, let us start rebuilding." And so they began this good work. Sean.
It's such a powerful story in the book of Nehemiah. He was a leader that led with such incredible courage. But I'd also say he didn't just go with courage. He also went with passion. And there's something about going with courage and going with passion that just lends the mission to really gain momentum. What I love about Nehemiah chapter 2 is it says that they began this good work. You turn into chapter 3 and you see a list of all kinds of names of people who participated in the good work. We're going to talk about those people in just a moment. What's fascinating about chapter 3 is you look at all the different names and all the different people who participated in this great work. There's very little descriptive words to describe who they are or the way they did what they did, except for one verse. In one verse, there's a descriptive term that describes how this one individual built. Here's what it says in Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 20. It says this. It says, "Next to him, Baruch, son of Zabai," look at the word, "zealously repaired another section." There's something about him. He was zealous. He was enthusiastic. He was passionate. I mean, he was all in. And what's fascinating about chapter 3 is you read all kinds of different names, people from all kinds of different backgrounds, different professions, different skill sets, different families. There's so much different about them. However, they were all joined together. And they were joined together, united together for one cause, one purpose, one mission that they were passionately sold out for. I mean, I love the heartbeat of it. When I think about somebody who's like zealous or passionate or sold out or fully enthusiastic, I'm reminded about like sporting events where you see the fan that like took it a little too far. Are you with me? I mean, the guy that like totally painted his face and body, he's wearing whatever the costume is that represents the team. I mean, he's a guy who's zealous, he's sold out, he's enthusiastic, he's incredibly passionate. Now, it's one thing on the sports field. What I really love, what I'm really inspired by, are those who do the very same thing when it's connected to God's work. I think about this last week. I know we've already celebrated it, but I think about 1 million seed packs that have been planted across all of our locations. But I don't know if you know this. What's behind that is there's actually a fairly small group of volunteers who works around the clock, like year round, in order to plan, prepare, get all the logistics straight. They order all the seeds. They get them to the right locations. They recruit over 8,000 volunteers. They get mobilized across all the locations. And it's because of that that the 1 million seed packs are able to be put together. But what's behind that is this group of volunteers. And if you meet these volunteers, I know them personally. They are passionate, enthusiastic, zealous. And why are they sold out? Because it's a cause worth trading one's time for. It's a cause worth trading one's life for. It's the opportunity to be a part of something that's significant, this kind of world-changing type of work. It reminds me of what's recorded for us in the book of Romans. Romans says this, it says, never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Like never be lacking in zeal. In other words, when it comes to God's work and the things of God, we don't want to be apathetic toward it. We want to be like ho-hum toward it. We want to be a community of people who are sold out to the mission of Jesus, sold out, passionately committed, enthusiastic. We are all in for the sake of the mission. I think that's what it takes to be a world-changing type of community. Now, if you've been around here for a while, you know that the mission, as we stated around here at Willow Creek, we say we want to be a church that loves God, loves people to do what? To change the world. That last part, I don't know about you, but to me, I'm like, doesn't that feel a little grandiose? I mean, I get being a community that loves God. I want to do that really well. I mean, I get being a community that loves people. I want to do that really well. But I mean, can we really be a world-changing type of church? Here's what makes it not grandiose for me. Here's what I believe about God. God is actually already at work in our world. God is already at work in the lives of people all over the globe. And the true world-changing type of work is a work done from God. We don't actually change the world. We partner with a God who's already doing it. And so the truth is, for us as a church, as a community, is to be very perceptive on the lookout. Like, where is God already at work, and how do we join God in what God is already doing? And how do we join him with enthusiasm, with passion, with commitment, with a sense of zeal, that we don't want to be lacking in zeal? We want to give everything that we have to serve this God who's doing incredible, incredible things in this world. Now, you and I both know that there's a lot of brokenness in our world. We see it in our own country. We see it as we begin to look all over the world. And God's already at work in all the brokenness and all the pain and all the hardship and all the trouble. God is already at work there. But when the local church begins to see the work that God is already doing and is willing to zealously partner with God, we see some amazing, amazing things happen. I think about our partner in the country of Jordan. Now, I don't know if you know this, but in the country of Jordan, they receive the second most number of refugees than any other country in the world. This past year, they had 760,000 like registered refugees living in the country of Jordan. They come from a lot of places. They come from Syria or Iraq, come from Sudan or Palestine. Refugees fleeing a lot of conflict that exists in that part of the world. Now, as we think about that, we think about what that would look like. And God, again, we believe is already at work in the lives of those refugees. What I love about the local church in Amman, the works with our partner there, is they are committed, passionate, enthusiastic to serve the refugees because they have such incredible need. And so it's not just about providing food and clothing and shelter, although they also do that. I was really inspired by the story of one of those local churches. And they were zealously responding to those refugees, and they set up what they called the Joy Club. It's basically an education program primarily designed for kids between the age of 4 and 6 years old who are not yet able to go to the government-run schools. But yeah, they wanted a safe landing place for these little children. And so it's a place they call the Joy Club, because they want these kids who probably didn't experience a lot of joy in their early years in their homeland to be able to experience joy maybe for the very first time in their presence. Now, one of the things they asked these kids to do as a part of the Joy Club is to draw a picture. And on one side of the picture, they asked them to kind of display or to illustrate what life was like in their home country. And then on the other side of the piece of paper, to illustrate what life was like in Jordan. Now, here is one of those pictures that I wanted to show you. You see on the right, you see a kid who came from a war-torn area in the country of Iraq. And he draws all kinds of images of burning buildings and missiles coming down from planes. There's even somebody who's passed away on the side of the road, an explosion. I can't imagine what it's like for this to be the images and the real playing through the mind and the heart of a 4 to 6-year-old. And yet on the left side of the drawing, look what life has been like since coming to Jordan. It just talks about living in peace. And this is my home. And this is the people from the church that came to help us out. And here's the church. My life in Jordan is much more happy. And there's something about this image that really does something in my heart. I don't know if it does something in your heart as well. But I think about a group from a local church who becomes so committed to God's work to serve those in a desperate need situation and provide God's love, God's grace, God's mercy, God's hope to a group of young people who so desperately needed it. And so I think about today, the opportunity that you and I have the chance to come alongside of our global partner and give of resources and of prayers in truly life-changing, eternity-altering ways. There's a group of refugees halfway across the world that will be impacted because of decisions that we collectively get to make as a church today. And so we want to be a church just like in Nehemiah. We want to be a church that goes with courage. We want to be a church that goes with compassion. And ultimately, and maybe primarily, we want to be a church that goes together.
I believe it was an African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, then go together. Because we can do more together than we can on our own. You know, over the past couple of weeks, at all of our locations, we've had panels out and asked people if they wanted to join us in committing to support our partners around the world, to go ahead and sign that panel. And even with our online crowd, we said, if you want to be a part of this, you give us your name and we'll sign your name on the wall. And so what you see behind me is the sum of our entire church come together, all locations, online, all of us signing a wall and saying, we want to stand together and fuel the ministry of our global partners around the world. I think we could celebrate that we're building the wall together. Listen, I don't know if you followed any of the NFL draft that's been going on or seen some of the videos of the players when they get a call from the coach. Have you seen any of these videos where they get a call from the coach? In every circumstance, none of them are alone. All of them get that call that says you're going to be drafted into the NFL, and they've got a crowd of people around them. Why? Who are those people? Well, that's mom and dad, who drove them to Little League practice. That's the coach from their middle school team and their high school team. That's their trainer who's been helping them lift weights and gain some weight and be ready for the NFL. That's their agent who helped them get their deal. It's this whole group of people who came around this one person to pull this off. Here's the deal. If you can accomplish your dream alone, then it is not a God-sized dream. We want to go, but we want to go together. And chapter 3 of Nehemiah is basically a list of all of the people that joined together to rebuild this wall, which, if you have my job, presents an interesting challenge. How do you teach basically a list full of names that are basically hard to pronounce. What can I say about this list? But let me give it a try. In verse 1, it says, Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. Basically, the priests, the religious leaders, they got together, and what they were responsible for was the sheep gate. This is where they would bring animals into the city to then bring them to the temple for sacrifice. And what I love about that is that the priests went first. The leaders went first. It wasn't like the religious leaders got up and said, well, hey, we're gonna ask you all to do a bunch of stuff, but when it comes to manual labor, when it comes to hard work, hey, listen, I've got a sermon to prepare. What I love is that the leaders went first. May we always be a church where leaders are the example and not the exception. I love that verse. In verse 8, it says, Uziel, son of Harhiah, the goldsmith, and Hananiah, the perfume maker, helped repair a section. And I don't know a lot of jewelers and perfume makers, but I never assumed that they were great at concrete work. And yet here is this little detail that says that the jeweler and the perfume maker were involved in building the wall. And in verse 12, there's a man who's mentioned who says he brought his daughters to build the wall. An interesting detail, because back then, mostly it was gonna be the sons, it was gonna be the men that were gonna do the labor. The women were gonna be taking care of things at home. That was their culture. But this stood out because maybe this man didn't have sons, I don't know, or maybe he had some really zealous daughters, I don't know. But it's basically saying, hey, listen, we were all there. The women were there, the men were there. The blue-collar folks were there. The white-collar folks were there. The skilled folks were there. The unskilled folks were there. Every one of us were working together to build this wall. And I love that vision. Now, there's one part of this that I really want to highlight for us in chapter 3. There are a number of these gates that are mentioned. I mentioned the sheep gate. There was also the horse gate. There was the valley gate. There was the fountain gate. I want to look at verses 13 and 14 where it says, the valley gate was repaired by Hunan and the residents of Zenoa. They rebuilt it and they put its doors and bolts and bars in place. They also repaired 500 yards, that's five football fields, 500 yards of the wall, and they got as far as the dung gate. I wonder why they stopped right there. I wonder what it was. They were working in August, we know that. I wonder what it was about that hot summer day that they got to the dung gate and said, you know what, why don't we just, this is enough. We're gonna take a break right here. I don't know, but here's what I know. In verse 14, thank God for Malchijah, because it says the dung gate was repaired by Malchijah. And here's what I wanna point out. Which part of the gate, which part of the wall is the most important wall, or most important part? Every part. Can you imagine having a wall that goes all the way around the city except for the dung gate where people said, woo, that doesn't sound like pleasant work, so we're not gonna build that part? Certainly not, because the wall is only as good as its weakest part. In fact, one of the things Nehemiah did was he had people grouped into families, and he had them work on the part of the wall that was in front of their house, because he knew that they were gonna build strong parts. They weren't gonna cut corners when it came to the part of the wall that was in front of their house. And so every part of the wall was super important. And I have a vision for a church that would say, hey, every part is important. Every one of us doing our job is important. Every one of us serving is important. Every one of us praying is important. Every one of us inviting friends is important. And every one of us giving is important. And so I wanna throw a goal out there. I know that we've said we wanna raise $1 million. But I think in addition to that, what I'd love to say is I'd love to see a goal where 100% of us participate in this offering today. That every one of our gifts is important. I wanna ask you, don't miss the opportunity to write your name Maybe you missed the opportunity to write your name on the wall. Don't miss your opportunity to write your name into the story that God is telling about celebration of hope in this year. Well, I'm consistently inspired by the stories of our global partners. Pastor Ezekiel is one of the partners in the Dominican Republic. And a few years ago, God gave him a God-sized vision. And like Nehemiah, he chose to go with courage, go with passion, and go together with others to see this vision become a reality. Take a look at his story.
Yo crecí en la montaña de Las Lomas, de República Dominicana. No tenía una comunidad, no solo un abrazo de padre, abrazo de madre. No tenía alimentación, no tenía techo, no tenía apoyo ni nada. Pero el amor de Dios siempre estuvo ahí conmigo. Mi nombre es Ezequiel Pérez y esta es mi historia. Entre los 8 o 9 años me destaqué en el béisbol.
Eso.
Así que yo me preguntaba si jugando béisbol podía tener la alimentación, la educación. Y ya a los 13 años yo empecé a jugar en las academias de béisbol. Siempre luchaba, trabajaba fuerte. Porque entendía que a través del béisbol yo podía lograr aquello que no tuve en mi niñez. Y un día que pensé que era el día más feliz de mi vida en el béisbol, momento por el cual había luchado tanto, que iba a firmar con los Twins de Minnesota. Le dije a Dios, si yo no firmo hoy, es porque tú me llamas al ministerio pastoral. Así que al día siguiente me presenté a los Twins de Minnesota y no fui seleccionado por el equipo. Pero sé que hicimos un acuerdo y voy al ministerio. Ahí entonces me iban a pastorear la barrera de Asua. Cuando fui a pastorear, no tenía nada. Me instalan como pastor con 10 pesos, 7 guineos maduros y una espinaca. Y allí fui a pastorear. Luego entonces fui al seminario. No tenía quien costeara mis estudios en el seminario. Tuve que lavar muchos inodoros, limpiar mucho el pasto. Y me enviaron a Monte Plata a pastorear. Casi 4 años allí. Estaba gustando vivir en Monte Plata y no quería ir a mi comunidad donde salí. Porque entendía que esa comunidad también me necesitaba en Monte Plata ahí. Pero la voz de Dios me dijo, yo te llamo. La voz de Dios me habló y me dijo, quiero que pastoree donde naciste, porque muchos niños, muchas niñas están pasando lo que tú pasaste y quiero que utilice todo lo que he hecho por ti en beneficio de ellos.
Thank you.
Cuando regresé a Las Lomas, todo estaba igual como lo dejé. Niños huérfanos, viudas, sin educación, sin deporte, sin atención. Y eso chocó mi corazón. Un día, el Señor me dijo, mira la montaña. Quiero que hagas un play para mí. Al principio, muchos se burlaban de nosotros. Decían, ¿dónde están los recursos para construir un play? Además, no cabe un play ahí. Pero este plan era de Dios. Sé que reunimos las personas. Compramos el terreno. Hicimos el play. Y lo hicimos. Desde entonces, le hemos construido casa a los niños, baños, hemos reparado sus pisos, hemos enseñado inglés para que puedan hablar con los scouts cuando vienen a nuestra academia, le hemos regalado cama para que puedan dormir cómodo. Y lo más importante, hemos impactado su vida espiritual a través de Cristo. Entonces ahí me di cuenta que el plan de Dios no era en que yo trabajara y luchara para mí, sino que el Señor me traía aquí para que estos niños tengan una mejor vida, mejor que la que yo tenía. Y es ahí donde veo el plan de Dios justificado día tras día. En la alegría, en el gozo de esos niños y niñas. Y aquí estamos, sirviendo al Señor, haciendo la vida feliz, creyendo que lo imposible no existe.